could freeze the bollocks off the King of Japan and she wanted to. Jamie's mouth twitched. Duncan's may be caught short, he said. Whatever the reason, he's been to the necessary house 4 times this morning. My own brows went up at this. Duncan suffered from chronic constipation. In fact, I had brought a packet of senna leaves and coffee plant roots for him, in spite of Jamie's rude remarks about what constituted a suitable wedding present. Duncan must be more nervous than I'd thought.
Well, it's no going to be any great surprise to my aunt and her wee 3 husbands before him, Jamie said in reply to a murmured remark of Hamilton's. It'll be the first time Duncan's been married, though. That's a shock to any man. I remember my own wedding night, aye?
He grinned at me, and I felt the heat rise in my cheeks. I remembered it too, vividly. Don't you think it's rather warm out here? I flicked my fan into an arc of ivory lace and fluttered it over my cheeks.
Really?
He said, still grinning at me.
I hadn't taken notice of it.
Duncan has, Ninian put in, his wrinkled lips pursed closed, holding in the laughter, sweating like a steamed pudding when I saw him last.
It was, in fact, a little chilly out, in spite of the cast-iron tubs full of hot embers that sent the sweet smell of applewood smoke wisping up from the corners of the stone terrace. Spring had sprung, and the lawns were fresh and green as were the trees along the river. But the morning air still held a sharp nip of winter's bite. It was still winter in the mountains, and we had encountered snow as far south as Greensboro on our journey toward River Run, though daffodils and crocuses poked bravely through it. It was a clear, bright March day now, though, and house, terrace, lawn and garden were thronged with wedding guests, glowing in their finery like an unseasonable flight of butterflies. Jocasta's wedding was clearly going to be the social event of the year, so far as Cape Fear society was concerned. There must be nearly 200 people here, from places as far distant as Halifax and Edenton.
Ninian said something to Jamie in low-voiced Gaelic, with a sidelong glance at me.
Jamie replied with a remark elegant in phraseology and extremely crude in content, blandly meeting my eye as the older man choked with laughter. I did, in fact, understand Gaelic fairly well by now, but there were moments when discretion was the better part of valour. I spread my fan wide, concealing my expression. True, it took some practice to achieve grace with a fan, but it was a useful social tool to someone cursed, as I was, with a glass face. Even fans had their limits, though. I turned away from the conversation, which gave every promise of degenerating further, and surveyed the party for signs of the absent bridegroom. Perhaps Duncan was truly ill, and not with nerves. If so, I should have a look at him.
Phaedra, have you seen Mr. Innes this morning?
Jocasta's body servant was flying past, her arms full of tablecloths, but came abruptly to a halt at my call.
"Ain't seen Mr. Duncan since breakfast, ma'am," she said, with a shake of her neatly capped head.
"How did he seem, then? Did he eat well?"
Breakfast was an ongoing affair of several hours, the resident guests serving themselves from the sideboard and eating as they chose. It was more likely nerves than food poisoning that was troubling Duncan's bowels, but some of the sausage I had seen on the sideboard struck me as highly suspect.
"No, ma'am, nary a bite."
Phaedra's smooth brow puckered. She was fond of Duncan. Cook tried to tempt him with a nice coddled egg, but he just shook his head and looked peaked.
"He did take a cup of rum punch, though," she said,
seeming somewhat cheered of thought.
"Aye, that'll settle him," Ninian remarked, overhearing. "Dinna trouble yourself, Mrs. Clare. Duncan will be well enough."
Fed curtsied and made off toward the tables being set up under the trees, starched apron flapping in the breeze. The succulent aroma of barbecuing pork wafted through the chill spring air, and fragrant clouds of hickory smoke rose from the fires near the smithy, where haunches of venison, sides of mutton, and broiled fowl in their dozens turned on spits. My stomach gurgled loudly in anticipation, despite the tight lacing of my stays. Neither Jamie nor Ninian appeared to notice, but I took a discreet step away turning to survey the lawn that stretched from the terrace to the river landing. I wasn't so positive of the virtues of rum, particularly taken on an empty stomach. Granted, Duncan wouldn't be the first groom to go to the altar in an advanced state of intoxication, but still. Brianna, brilliant in blue wool, the colour of the spring sky, was standing near one of the marble statues that graced the lawn, Jemmy balanced on her hip, deep in conversation with Gerald Forbes, the lawyer. She also had a fan, but at the moment it was being put to better use than usual. Jemmy had got hold of it and was munching on the ivory handle, a look of fierce concentration on his small pink face. Of course, Brianna had less need of good fan technique than I did, she having inherited Jamie's ability to hide all thoughts behind a mask of pleasant blandness. She had the mask in place now, which gave me a good idea of her opinion of Mr. Forbes. Where was Roger? I wondered. He'd been with her earlier. I turned to ask Jamie what he thought of this epidemic of disappearing husbands, only to discover that he had joined it. Ninian Hamilton had turned away to talk to someone else, and the space at my side was now occupied by a pair of slaves staggering under the weight of a fresh demijohn of brandy wine as they headed for the refreshment tables. I stepped hastily out of their way and turned to look for Jamie. He had vanished into the crowd like a grouse into heather. I turned slowly, surveying the terrace and lawns, but there wasn't a sign of him among the milling crowd. I frowned against the bright sunlight, shading my eyes with my hand. It wasn't as though he were inconspicuous, after all. A Highlander with the blood of Viking giants in his veins, he stood head and shoulders above most men, and his hair caught the sun like polished bronze. To add icing to the cake, he was dressed today in his best to celebrate Jocasta's wedding. A belted plaid in crimson and black tartan, with his good grey coat and waistcoat, and the gaudiest pair of red and black argyle stockings ever to grace a Scotsman's shins. He should have stood out like a splotch of blood on fresh linen. I didn't find him, but did see a familiar face. I stepped off the terrace and eeled my way through the knots of partygoers. "Mr. McLennan!" He turned toward my call, looking surprised, but then a cordial smile spread across his blunt features. "Mrs. Fraser." "How lovely to see you," I said, giving him my hand. "How are you?" He looked much better than when last seen, clean and decent in a dark suit and plain laced hat. There were hollows in his cheeks, though, and a shadow behind his eyes that remained even as he smiled at me. "Oh, I'm well enough, ma'am, quite well." "Are you... where are you living these days?" That seemed a more delicate question than, "Why aren't you in jail?" No fool, he answered both questions. "Oh, well, your husband was so kind as to write to Mr. Ninian there." He nodded across the lawn toward the lean figure of Ninian Bell Hamilton, who was in the middle of a heated discussion of some kind. "And to tell him of my trouble. Mr. Ninian's a great friend to the regulation, Ken, and a great friend of Judge Henderson's forby." He shook his head, mouth pursed in puzzlement. "I couldn't say quite how it fell out, but Mr. Ninian came and fetched me out of the jail and took me into his own household. So I am there for the present. 'Twas kind, very kind." He spoke with evident sincerity, and yet with a certain air of abstraction. He fell silent then. He was still looking at me, but his eyes were blank. I groped for something to say, hoping to bring him back to the present, but a shout from Ninian brought him out of his trance, saving me the trouble. Abel excused himself politely to me and went to assist in the argument. I strolled down the lawn, nodding to acquaintances over my fan. I was glad to see Abel again and know he was physically well, at least, but I couldn't deny that the sight of him cast a chill over my heart. I had the feeling that, in fact, it made little difference to Abel McLennan where his body resided. His heart still lay in the grave with his wife. Why had Ninian brought him today, I wondered. Surely a wedding couldn't but recall his own marriage to him. weddings did that to everyone. The sun had risen high enough to warm the air, but I shivered. The sight of McLennan's grief reminded me too much of the days after Culloden, when I had gone back to my own time, knowing Jamie dead. I knew too well that deadness of heart, the sense of sleepwalking through the days and lying open-eyed at night, finding no rest, knowing only emptiness that wasn't peace. Jocasta's voice floated down from the terrace calling to Ulysses. She had lost three husbands and now was fixed to take a fourth. Blind she might be, but there was no deadness in her eyes. Did that mean she hadn't cared deeply for any of her husbands, I wondered? Or only that she was a woman of great strength, capable of overcoming grief, not once, but over and over again? I had done it once, myself, for Brianna's sake. But Jocasta had no children, not now at least. Had she once had them, and put aside the pain of a sundered heart to live for a child? I shook myself, trying to dispel such melancholy thoughts. It was, after all, a festive occasion, and a day to match. The dogwoods in the grove were in bloom, and courting bluebirds and cardinals shot in and out of the greening trees like bits of confetti, crazed with lust. "But of course they have," a woman was saying in an authoritative tone of voice. "My God, they've shared a house for months now."
"Aye, that's so," one of her companions agreed, sounding doubtful. "But you wouldna think it from the looks of them. Why, they scarcely glance at each other. Well, of course, she cannot be looking at him, blind as she is, but you'd think..."
It wasn't only the birds, I thought, amused. A certain sense of rising sap suffused the whole gathering. Glancing up at the terrace, I could see young women clustered, tittering and gossiping in small groups like hens, while the men strode, oh, so casually, up and down in front of them, gaudy as peacocks in their party clothes. I wouldn't be surprised if at least a few engagements resulted from this celebration, and a few pregnancies as well. Sex was in the air. I could smell it, under the heady fragrances of spring flowers and cooking food. The sense of melancholy had quite left me, though I still had a strong urge to find Jamie. I had gone down one side of the lawn and up the other, but saw no sign of him anywhere between the big plantation house and the dock, where slaves in livery were still greeting latecomers arriving by water. Among those still expected, and very late indeed, was the priest who was to perform the wedding. Father Leclerc was a Jesuit, bound from New Orleans to a mission near Quebec, but seduced from the strict path of duty by a substantial donation made by Jocasta to the Society of Jesus. Money might not buy happiness, I reflected, but it was a useful commodity nonetheless. I glanced in the other direction and stopped dead. At one side, Ronnie Campbell caught my eye and bowed. I lifted my fan in acknowledgement, but was too distracted to speak to him. I hadn't found Jamie, but I just spotted the likely reason for his abrupt disappearance. Ronnie's father, Farquhar Campbell, was coming up the lawn from the landing, accompanied by a gentleman in the red and fawn of His Majesty's Army, and another in naval uniform, Lieutenant Wolfe. The sight gave me an unpleasant shock. Lieutenant Wolfe was not my favourite person. He wasn't all that popular with anyone else who knew him either. I suppose it was reasonable for him to have been invited, as His Majesty's Navy was the principal buyer of River Run's production of timber, tar and turpentine, and Lieutenant Wolfe was the Navy's representative in such matters. And it was possible that Jocasta had invited him for more personal reasons as well. The Lieutenant had, at one point, asked her to marry him. Not, as she had dryly noted, from any desire for her person, but rather to get his hands on River Run. Yes, I could see her enjoying the lieutenant's presence here today. Duncan, less naturally given to ulterior motives and manipulations, might not. Farquhar Campbell had spotted me, and was making for me through the crowd, the armed forces in tow. I got my fan up and made the necessary facial adjustments for polite conversation, but, much to my relief, The lieutenant spotted a servant carrying a tray of glasses across the terrace and sheered off in pursuit, abandoning his escort in favour of refreshment. The other military gentleman glanced after him, but dutifully followed Farquhar. I squinted at him, but he was no one I'd met before, I was sure. Since the removal of the last Highland regiment in the autumn, the sight of a red coat was unusual anywhere in the colony. Who could this be? My features fixed in what I hoped was a pleasant smile, I sank into a formal curtsy, spreading my embroidered skirts to best advantage. "Mr. Campbell?" I glanced covertly behind him, but Lieutenant Wolfe had fortunately vanished in pursuit of alcoholic sustenance.
"Mrs. Fraser, your servant, ma'am."
Farquhar made me a graceful leg in reply. An elderly, desiccated-looking man, Mr. Campbell was sedate as usual in black broadcloth, a small burst of ruffles at the throat being his only concession to the festivities. He looked over my shoulder, frowning slightly in puzzlement.
I thought I had seen your husband with you.
Oh, well, I think he's, gone. I twiddled my fan delicately toward the trees where the necessary facilities lurked, separated from the main house by an aesthetic distance and a screen of small white pines.
Ah, I see. Just so.
Campbell cleared his throat and gestured to the man who accompanied him. Mrs. Fraser, may I present Major Donald MacDonald? Major MacDonald was a rather hawk-nosed but handsome gentleman in his late 30s, with a weathered face and erect bearing of a career soldier, and a pleasant smile belied by a pair of sharp blue eyes, the same pale, vivid shade as Brianna's dress.
"Your servant, ma'am."
He bowed very gracefully.
"May I say, ma'am, how particularly that colour becomes you?"
"You may," I said, relaxing a little. "Thank you."
"The Major is but recently arrived in Cross Creek. I assured him he would find no greater opportunity to pursue acquaintance with his countrymen and familiarise himself with his surroundings."
Farquhar swept a hand around the terrace, encompassing the party, which did indeed comprise a who's who of Scottish society along the Cape Fear.
"Indeed," the Major said politely, "I have not heard so many Scottish names since last I was in Edinburgh. Mr. Campbell gives me to understand that your husband is the nephew of Mrs. Cameron, or Mrs. Innes, perhaps I should say."
"Yes. Have you met Mrs. Innes yet?" I glanced toward the far end of the terrace. Still no sign of Duncan, let alone Roger or Jamie. Blast it, where was everybody? Holding summit conferences in the necessary house?
"No, but I shall look forward to presenting my compliments. The late Mr. Cameron was by way of being an acquaintance of my father, Robert MacDonald of Stornoway."
He inclined his wigged head a respectful inch in the direction of the small white marble building at the side of the lawn, the mausoleum that presently sheltered the fleshly remains of Hector Cameron.
"Has your husband any connection with the Frasers of Lovett, by chance?"
With an internal groan, I recognised a Scottish spiderweb in the making. The meeting of any two Scots invariably began with a casting out of skeins of inquiry until enough strands of relation and acquaintanceship had stuck to form a useful network. I tended to become entangled in the sticky strands of sept and clan myself, ending up like a fat, juicy fly thoroughly trapped and at the mercy of my questioner. Jamie had survived the intrigues of French and Scottish politics for years by means of such knowledge, though. Skating precariously along the secret strands of such webs, keeping away from the sticky snares of loyalty and betrayal that had doomed so many others. I settled myself to pay attention, struggling to place this MacDonald among the thousand others of his ilk. MacDonald of Keppoch, MacDonald of the Isles, MacDonald of Clan Ranald, MacDonald of Slate. How many kinds of MacDonalds were there anyway? I wondered a little crossly. Surely one or two should be sufficient to most purposes. MacDonald of the Isles, evidently. The Major's family hailed from the Isle of Harris. I kept one eye out during the interrogation, but Jamie had safely gone to earth. Farquhar Campbell, no mean player himself, seemed to be enjoying the verbal game of battledore and shuttlecock, his dark eyes flicking back and forth between me and the Major with a look of amusement. The amusement faded into a look of surprise as I finished a rather confused analysis of Jamie's paternal lineage in response to the Major's expert catechism.
"Your husband's grandfather was Simon Lord Lovett," Campbell said. "The old fox?"
His voice rose slightly with incredulity.
"Well, yes," I said a little uneasily.
"I thought you knew that."
"Indeed," said Farquhar. He looked as though he had swallowed a brandied plum, noticing too late that the stone was still in it. He'd known Jamie was a pardoned Jacobite, all right, but plainly Jocasta hadn't mentioned his close connection with the old fox, executed as a traitor for his role in the Stuart Rising. Most of the Campbells had fought on the government side of that particular brouhaha.
"Yes," MacDonald said, ignoring Campbell's reaction. He frowned slightly in concentration.
"I have the honour to be slightly acquainted with the present Lord Lovett. The title has been restored, I collect."
He went on, turning to Campbell in explanation.
"That would be young Simon, who raised a regiment to fight the French in 58? No, 57. Yes, 57. A gallant soldier, excellent fighting man. And he would be your husband's
nephew?
No, uncle."
"Half-uncle," I clarified. Old Simon had been married 3 times and made no secret of his extramarital byblows, of which Jamie's father had been one. No need to point that out, though.
MacDonald nodded, lean face clearing in satisfaction at having got it all neatly sorted. Farquhar's face relaxed a little, hearing that the family reputation had gone so far toward rehabilitation.
"Papist, of course," MacDonald added, "but an excellent soldier nonetheless."
"Speaking of soldiers," Campbell interrupted, "do you know..."
I breathed a sigh of relief that made my corset strings creak as Mr. Campbell smoothly led the Major into an analysis of some past military event. The Major, it seemed, wasn't on active duty, but, like many, presently retired on half pay. Unless and until the Crown found some further use for his services, he was thus left to mooch round the colonies in search of occupation. Peace was hard on professional soldiers.
"Just wait," I thought, with a small, premonitory shiver.
4 years or less, and the Major would be busy enough. I caught a flash of tartan from the corner of my eye and turned to look, but it was neither Jamie nor Duncan. One less mystery, though. It was Roger, dark-haired and handsome in his kilt. His face lit as he spotted Brianna, and his stride lengthened. She turned her head as though feeling his presence, and her own face brightened in answer. He reached her side, and without the least acknowledgement of the gentleman with her, embraced her and kissed her soundly on the mouth. As they drew apart, he held out his arms for Jemmy and dropped another kiss on the silky red head. I returned to the conversation at hand, belatedly realising that Farquhar Campbell had been talking for some time without my having any notion what he had said. Seeing my bemusement, he smiled a little wryly.
"I must go and pay my respects elsewhere, Mrs. Fraser," he said. "If you will pardon me, I shall leave you to the Major's excellent company."
He touched his hat courteously and eeled off toward the house, perhaps intending to track down Lieutenant Wolfe and stop him pocketing the silver. Thus marooned with me, the Major cast about for suitable conversation, and fell back upon the most commonly asked question between new acquaintances.
"Had you and your husband long arrived in the colony, ma'am?"
"Not long," I said, rather wary. 3 years or so. We live in a small settlement in the back country."
I waved my closed fan toward the invisible mountains to the west.
"A place called Fraser's Ridge."
"Ah, yes. I have heard of it."
A muscle twitched near the corner of his mouth, and I wondered uneasily just what he had heard. Jamie's still was an open secret in the back country, and among the Scottish settlers of the Cape Fear. In fact, several kegs of raw whisky from the still were sitting in plain sight by the stables. Jamie's wedding present to his aunt and Duncan. But I hoped the secret wasn't quite so open that an army officer newly arrived in the colony would already have heard about it.
"Tell me, Mrs. Fraser," he hesitated, then plunged ahead, "do you encounter a great deal of factionalism in your area of the colony?"
"Factionalism? Oh, no,
not a great deal."
I cast a wary eye toward Hector Cameron's mausoleum, where Herman Husband's dark Quaker grey showed up like a blot against the pure white marble. Factionalism was a code word for the activities of men like Husband and James Hunter, regulators. The governor's militia action in December had quashed the violent demonstrations, but the regulation was still a simmering pot under a very tight lid. Husband had been arrested and imprisoned for a short time in February on the strength of his pamphlets, but the experience had in no way softened either his disposition or his language. A boilover could happen at any time.
"I am pleased to hear it, ma'am," Major MacDonald said. "Do you hear much news, remotely situated as you are?"
"Not a great deal. Nice day, isn't it? We've been so fortunate in the weather this year. Was it an easy journey from Charleston? So early in the year, the mud?"
"Indeed, ma'am. We had some small difficulties, but no more than..."
The Major was assessing me quite openly as he chatted, taking in the cut and quality of my gown, the pearls at my throat and ears, borrowed from Jocasta, and the rings on my fingers. I was familiar with such a look. There was no hint of lechery or flirtation in it. He was simply judging my social standing and my husband's level of prosperity and influence. I took no offence. I was busy doing the same thing to him, after all. Well-educated and of good family, that much was plain from his rank alone, though the heavy gold signet on his right hand clinched the matter. Not personally well off, though. His uniform was worn at the seams, and his boots were deeply scarred, though well-polished. A light Scots accent, with a hint of French gutturality, experience in continental campaigns. And very newly arrived in the colony, I thought. His face was drawn from recent illness, and the whites of his eyes bore the slight tinge of jaundice, common to new arrivals who tended to contract everything from malaria to dengue fever when exposed to the seething germ pools of the coastal towns.
"Tell me, Mrs. Fraser," the Major began.
"You insult not only me, sir, but every man of honour here present."
Ninian Bell Hamilton's rather high-pitched voice rang out through a lull in the general conversation, and heads turned all over the lawn. He was face to face with Robert Barlow, a man I'd been introduced to earlier in the morning. A merchant of some kind, I vaguely recalled, from Edenton, or possibly New Bern. A heavy-set man, with the look of one unused to contradiction, he was sneering openly at Hamilton.
"Regulators, you call them? Jailbirds and rioters? You suggest that such men possess a sense of honour, do you?" "I do not suggest it. I state it as fact, and will defend it as such."
The old gentleman drew himself upright, hand groping for a sword hilt. Fortunately for the occasion, he wasn't wearing a sword. None of the gentlemen present were, given the congeniality of the gathering. Whether this fact affected Barlow's behaviour, I couldn't have said. But he laughed contemptuously and turned his back on Hamilton to walk away. The elderly Scot, inflamed, promptly kicked Barlow in the buttocks. Taken unaware and off balance, Barlow pitched forward, landing on hands and knees, his coattails ludicrously up over his ears. Whatever their respective political opinions, all the onlookers burst into laughter. Thus encouraged, Ninian puffed up like a bantam rooster and strutted round his fallen opponent to address him from the front. I could have told him that this was a tactical error, but then I had the benefit of seeing Barlow's face, which was crimson with mortified rage. Eyes bulging, he scrambled awkwardly to his feet and launched himself with a roar, knocking the smaller man flat. The two of them rolled in the grass, fists and coattails flying to whoops of encouragement from the spectators.
Wedding guests came rushing from lawn and terrace to see what was going on. Abel McLennan pushed his way through the mob, obviously intent on offering support to his patron. Richard Caswell seized his arm to prevent him, and he swung round, pushing Caswell off balance. James Hunter, lean face alight with glee, tripped Caswell, who sat down hard on the grass, looking surprised. Caswell's son, George, let out a howl of outrage and punched Hunter in the kidney. Hunter whirled round and slapped George on the nose. A number of ladies were shrieking, not all with shock. One or two appeared to be cheering on Ninian Hamilton, who'd got temporarily atop his victim's chest and was endeavouring to throttle him, though with little success, owing to Barlow's thick neck and heavy stock. I looked frantically round for Jamie, or Roger, or Duncan. God damn it, where were they all? George Caswell had fallen back in surprise, hands to his nose, which was dribbling blood down his shirt front. Dewayne Buchanan, one of Hamilton's sons-in-law, was shoving his way purposefully through the gathering crowd. I didn't know whether he meant to get his father-in-law off Barlow or assist him in his attempt to murder the man. "Oh, bloody hell," I murmured to myself. "Here, hold this." I thrust my fan at Major MacDonald and hitched up my skirts, preparing to wade into the melee and deciding whom to kick first and where for best effect.
"Do you want me to stop it?"
The Major, who'd been enjoying the spectacle, looked disappointed at the thought, but resigned to duty. At my rather startled nod, he reached for his pistol, pointed it skyward, and discharged it into the air. The bang was loud enough to temporarily silence everyone. The combatants froze, and in the momentary lull, Herman Husband shoved his way into the scene.
"Friend Ninian," he said, nodding cordially round. "Friend Buchanan, allow me."
He grabbed the elderly Scot by both arms and lifted him bodily off Barlow. He gave James Hunter a warning look. Hunter gave an audible "hm," but retired a few steps. The younger Mrs. Caswell, a woman of sense, had got her husband off the field of battle already and was applying a handkerchief to his nose. Dewayne Buchanan and Abel McLennan had each got hold of one of Ninian Hamilton's arms and were making a great show of restraining him as they marched him off toward the house, though it was reasonably apparent that either one of them could simply have picked him up and carried him. Richard Caswell had got up by himself, and while looking rather affronted, was evidently not disposed to hit anyone. He stood brushing dried grass from the back of his coat, lips pressed together in disapproval.
"Your fan, Mrs. Fraser."
Jerked from my appraisal of the conflict, I found Major MacDonald politely offering me back my fan. He looked quite pleased with himself.
"Thank you," I said, taking it and eyeing him with some respect. "Tell me, Major, do you always go about with a loaded pistol?"
"An oversight, ma'am," he replied blandly, "though perhaps a fortunate one, I had been in the town of Cross Creek yesterday, and as I was returning alone to Mr. Farcut Campbell's plantation after dark, I thought it would be as well to go canny on the road."
He nodded over my shoulder.
"Tell me, Mrs. Fraser, who is the ill-shaven individual? He seems a man of guts, despite his lack of address. Will he take up the cudgels in his own behalf now, do you think?"
I swung round to see Herman Husband nose to nose with the risen Barlow, his round black hat thrust down on his head and his beard bristling with pugnacity. Barlow stood his ground, red-faced and thunder-browed, but had his arms folded tightly across his chest as he listened to Husband.
"Herman Husband is a Quaker," I said, with a slight tone of reproof.
"No, he won't resort to violence. Just words." Quite a lot of words. Barlow kept trying to interject his own opinions, but Husband ignored these, pressing his argument with such enthusiasm that drops of spittle flew from the corners of his mouth.
"An heinous miscarriage of justice. Sheriffs, or so they call themselves, who have not been appointed by any legal writ, but rather appoint themselves for the purposes of corruptly enriching themselves and scorn all legitimate..."
Barlow dropped his arms and began to edge backward in an effort to escape the barrage. When Husband paused momentarily to draw breath, though, Barlow seized the opportunity to lean forward and jab a threatening finger into Husband's chest.
"You speak of justice, sir. What have riot and destruction to do with justice? If you advocate the ruin of property as means to redress your grievances, I do not. But is the poor man to fall a spoil to the unscrupulous, and his plight pass unregarded? I say to you, sir, God will unmercifully requite those who oppress the poor, and...
Who are they arguing about? MacDonald asked, viewing the exchange with interest.
Religion?
Seeing husband involved and realising that no further punch-ups were to be expected, most of the crowd had lost interest, wandering away toward the buffet tables and the braziers on the terrace. Hunter and a few other regulators hung about to give husband moral support, but most of the guests were planters and merchants. While they might side with Barlow in theory, in practice, most were disinclined to waste a rare festive occasion in controversy with Herman Husband over the rights of the taxpaying poor. I wasn't all that eager to examine the rhetoric of the regulation in detail either, but did my best to give Major MacDonald a crude overview of the situation. And so Governor Tryon felt obliged to raise the militia to deal with it. But the regulators backed down, I concluded. But they haven't abandoned their demands by any means. Husband hadn't abandoned his argument either. He never did. But Barlow had at last succeeded in extricating himself and was restoring his tissues at the refreshment tables under the elm trees in company with some sympathetic friends, who all cast periodic glances of disapproval in Husband's direction.
"I see," MacDonald said, interested. "Farquhar Campbell did tell me something of this disruptive movement. And the Governor has raised a militia on occasion to deal with it, you see. And me again. Who commands his troops, do you know?"
I believe General Waddell. That's Hugh Waddell, has command of several companies. But the Governor himself was in command of the main body. He's been a soldier himself."
"Has he indeed?"
MacDonald seemed to find this very interesting. He hadn't put away his pistol, but was fondling it in an absent-minded sort of way.
"Campbell tells me that your husband is the holder of a large grant of land in the back country. He is by way of being an intimate of the Governor?"
"I wouldn't put it that strongly," I said dryly.
"But he does know the Governor, yes." I felt a trifle uneasy at this line of conversation. It was, strictly speaking, illegal for Catholics to hold royal land grants in the colonies. I didn't know whether Major MacDonald was aware of that fact, but he did plainly realise that Jamie was likely a Catholic, given his family background.
"Do you suppose your husband might be prevailed upon for an introduction, dear lady?"
The pale blue eyes were bright with speculation, and I realised suddenly what he was after. A career soldier with no war was at a distinct disadvantage in terms of occupation and income. The regulation might be a tempest in a teapot, but on the other hand, if there was any prospect of military action... After all, Tryon had no regular troops. He might well be inclined to welcome and to pay an experienced officer if the militia were called out again. I cast a wary eye toward the lawn. Husband and his friends had withdrawn a bit and were in close conversation in a little knot near one of Jocasta's new statues. If the recent near brawl was any indication, the regulation was still dangerously on the boil.
"That might be done," I said cautiously.
I couldn't see any reason why Jamie would object to providing a letter of introduction to Tryon, and I did owe the Major something, after all, for having averted a full-scale riot. "You'd have to ask my husband, of course, but I'd be happy to put in a word for you."
"You shall have my utmost gratitude, ma'am."
He put away his pistol and bowed low over my hand. Straightening up, he glanced over my shoulder.
"I think I must take my leave now, Mrs. Fraser, but I shall hope to make your husband's acquaintance soon."
The Major marched off toward the terrace, and I turned to see Herman Husband stumping toward me, Hunter and a few other men in his wake.
"Mrs. Fraser, I must ask thee to give my good wishes and my regrets to Mrs. Innes, if thee will," he said without preamble. "I must go."
"Oh, must you leave so soon?"
I hesitated. On the one hand, I wanted to urge him to stay. On the other, I could foresee further trouble if he did. Barlow's friends hadn't taken their eyes off him since the near brawl.
He saw the thought cross my face and nodded soberly. The flush of debate had faded from his face, leaving it set in grim lines.
"It will be better so. Jocasta Cameron has been a good friend to me and mine. It would ill repay her kindness for me to bring discord to her wedding celebrations. I would not choose that. And yet I cannot in conscience remain silent, hearing such pernicious opinions as I have received here."
He gave Barlow's group a look of cold contempt, which was met in kind.
"Besides," he added, turning his back on the Barlowites in dismissal, "we have business that compels our attention elsewhere."
He hesitated, clearly wondering whether to tell me more, but then decided against it.
"Thee will tell her."
"Yes, of course, Mr. Husband. I'm sorry." He gave me a faint smile, tinged with melancholy, and shook his head, but said no more. As he left, though, trailed by his companions, James Hunter paused to speak to me, low-voiced.
"Regulators are a-gathering. There's a big camp up near Salisbury," he said. "You might see fit to tell your husband that."
He nodded, put his hand to his hat-brim, and without waiting for acknowledgement, strode off, his dark coat disappearing in the crowd like a sparrow swallowed by a flock of peacocks. From my vantage point at the edge of the terrace, I could see the whole sweep of the party, which flowed in a stream of festivity from house to river, its eddy pools obvious to the knowledgeable eye. Jocasta formed the eye of the largest social swirl, but smaller pools swirled ominously around Ninian Bell Hamilton and Richard Caswell, and a restless current meandered through the party, leaving deposits of conversation along its edges, rich in the fertile silt of speculation. From the things I overheard, the question of our host's putative sex life was the predominant subject of conversation, but politics ran a close second. I still saw no sign either of Jamie or of Duncan. There was the Major again, though. He stopped, a glass of cider in each hand. He had caught sight of Brianna. I smiled, watching. Brianna often stopped men in their tracks, though not always from admiration. She had inherited a number of things from Jamie, slanted blue eyes and flaming hair, a long straight nose and a wide, firm mouth, the bold facial bones that came from some ancient Norseman. In addition to these striking attributes, though, she had also inherited his height. In a time when the average woman stood a hair less than 5 feet tall, Brianna reached 6. People were inclined to stare. Major MacDonald was doing so, cider forgotten in his hands. Roger noticed. He smiled and nodded, but took that one step closer to Brianna that said unmistakably, "She's mine, mate." Watching the Major in conversation, I noticed how pale and spindly he looked by comparison with Roger, who stood nearly as tall as Jamie. He was broad-shouldered and olive-skinned, and his hair shone black as a crow's wing in the spring sun, perhaps the legacy of some ancient Spanish invader. I had to admit that there was no noticeable resemblance between him and little Jem, ruddy as a fresh-forged brass candlestick. I could see the flash of white as Roger smiled. The Major kept his lips pulled down when smiling, as most people over the age of 30 did, to hide the gaps and decay that were endemic. Perhaps it was the stress of the Major's occupation, I thought. Perhaps merely the effects of poor nourishment. Being of good family didn't mean a child in this time ate very well. I ran my tongue lightly over my own teeth, testing the biting edge of my incisors. Straight and sound, and I took considerable pains to see they would stay that way, given the current state of the art of dentistry.
"Why, Mrs. Fraser?"
A light voice broke in on my thoughts, and I looked round to find Philip Wiley at my elbow.
"Whatever can you be thinking, my dear? You look positively feral."
He took my hand and lowered his voice, baring his own fairly decent teeth in a suggestive smile.
"I'm not your dear," I said with some acerbity, jerking my hand out of his. "And as for feral, I'm surprised no one has bitten you in the backside yet." "Oh, I have hopes," he assured me, eyes twinkling.
He bowed, managing in the process to get hold of my hand again.
Might I have the honour to claim a dance later, Mrs. Fraser?
Indeed you may not, I said, tugging. Let go.
Your wish is my command.
He let go, but not before planting a light kiss on the back of my hand. I suppressed the urge to wipe the moist spot on my skirt.
Go away, child, I said.
I flicked my fan at him.
Shoo!
Philip Wiley was a dandy. I had met him twice before, and on both occasions he'd been got up regardless. Satin breeches, silk stockings, and all the trappings that went with them, including powdered wig, powdered face, and a small black crescent beauty mark stuck dashingly beside one eye. Now, however, the rot had spread. The powdered wig was mauve. The satin waistcoat was embroidered with... I blinked. Yes, with lions and unicorns done in gold and silver thread. The satin breeches were fitted to him like a bifurcated glove, and the crescent had given way to a star at the corner of his mouth. Mr. Wiley had become a macaroni with cheese.
Oh, I have no intention of deserting you, Mrs. Fraser, he assured me. I have been searching everywhere for you.
Oh, well, you found me, I said, eyeing his coat, which was velvet, rose in colour, and had 6-inch cuffs of palest pink silk and button covers embroidered with scarlet peonies.
Though it's no wonder you had trouble. I expect you were blinded by the glare from your waistcoat.
Lloyd Stanhope was with him, as usual, quite as prosperous, but much more plainly dressed than his friend. Stanhope guffawed, but Wiley ignored him and bowed low, making me a graceful leg.
Ah, well, Fortuna has smiled upon me this year. The trade with England has quite recovered, may the gods be thanked, and I have had my share of it, and more besides. You must come with me to see...
I was saved at this point by the sudden appearance of Adlai Osborne, a well-to-do merchant from somewhere up the coast, who tapped Wiley on the shoulder. Seizing the opportunity afforded by the distraction, I put up my fan and sidled away through a gap in the crowd. Left momentarily to my own devices, I strolled nonchalantly off the terrace and down the lawn. I still had an eye out for Jamie or Duncan, but this was my first opportunity to examine Jocasta's latest acquisitions, which were causing considerable comment among the wedding guests. These were two statues carved from white marble, one standing squarely in the centre of each lawn. The one closest to me was a life-size replica of a Greek warrior. Spartan, I assumed, from the fact that the more frivolous items of attire had been omitted, leaving the gentleman clad in a sturdy-looking plumed helmet with a sword in one hand. A large shield was planted at his feet, strategically placed so as to cover the more glaring deficiencies of his wardrobe. There was a matching statue on the right lawn, this one of Diana the Huntress. While the lady was rather skimpily draped, and her shapely white marble breasts and buttocks were attracting a certain amount of sidelong appreciation from the gentlemen present, she was no match for her companion in terms of public fascination. I smiled behind my fan, seeing Mr. and Mrs. Sherston swan past the statue without so much as a glance. After all, their raised noses and bored looks at each other said, such artworks were commonplace in Europe. Only rude colonials, lacking both experience and breeding, would consider it a spectacle, my dear. Examining the statue myself, I discovered that it wasn't an anonymous Greek after all, but rather Perseus. From this new angle, I could see what I had assumed to be a rock resting beside the shield was, in fact, the severed head of a gorgon, half its snake standing on end in shocked dismay. The evident artistry of these reptiles was affording an excuse for close examination of the statue by a number of ladies who were brazening it out, pursing their lips knowingly, and making sounds of admiration about the sculptor's skilfulness in rendering every scale just so. Every so often, one would allow her eyes to dart upward for a split second, before jerking her gaze back to the gorgon, cheeks reddened by the morning air and the mulled wine being served, no doubt. My attention was distracted from Perseus by a steaming mug of this beverage thrust beneath my nose in invitation.
"Do have some, Mrs. Fraser?"
It was Lloyd Stanhope, roundly amiable,
You wouldn't want to take a chill, dear lady.
There was no danger of that, given the increasing warmth of the day. But I accepted the cup, enjoying the scent of cinnamon and honey that wafted from it. I leaned to one side, looking for Jamie, but he was still nowhere to be seen. A group of gentlemen arguing the merits of Virginia tobacco versus indigo as a crop were clustered round one side of Perseus, while the statue's rear aspect now sheltered three young girls who were glancing at it from behind their fans, red-faced and giggling.
"Unique," Philip Wiley was saying to someone.
The eddies of conversation had brought him back to my side.
"Absolutely unique. Black pearls, they're called. Never seen anything like them, I'll wager."
He glanced round and, seeing me, reached out to touch my elbow lightly.
"I collect you have spent some time in France, Mrs. Fraser. Have you seen them there, perhaps?"
"Black pearls," I said, scrambling to catch hold of the threads of conversation. "Well, yes, a few.
I recall the Archbishop of Rouen had a small Moorish page-boy who wore a very large one in his nose."
Stanhope's jaw sagged ludicrously. Wiley stared at me for a split second, then uttered a whoop of laughter so loud that both the tobacco lobby and the giggling girls stopped dead and stared at us.
"You will be the death of me, my dear lady,"
Wiley wheezed as Stanhope declined into choked snorts of mirth. Wiley drew out a lace kerchief and dabbed delicately at the corners of his eyes, lest tears of merriment blotch his powder.
"Really, Mrs. Fraser, have you not seen my treasures?"
He grasped my elbow and propelled me out of the crowd with surprising skill.
"Come, let me show you."
He guided me smoothly through the gathering throng and past the side of the house, where a flagged path led toward the stables. Another crowd, mostly men, was clustered round the paddock, where Jocasta's groom was throwing down hay for several horses. There were five of them, two mares, a couple of two-year-olds, and a stallion. All five black as coal, with coats that gleamed in the pale spring sun, even shaggy as they were with winter hair. I was no expert in horse conformation, but knew enough by now to notice the deep chests, barreled vaults, and sculpted quarters, which gave them a peculiar but deeply appealing look of elegant sturdiness. Beyond the beauties of conformation and coat, though, what was most striking about these horses was their hair. These black horses had great floating masses of silky hair, almost like women's hair, that rose and fluttered with their movements, matching the graceful fall of their long, full tails. In addition, each horse had delicate black feathers decorating hoof and fetlock that lifted like floating milkweed seed with each step. By contrast to the usual raw-boned riding horses and rough draft animals used for haulage, these horses seemed almost magical, and from the awed comment they were occasioning among the spectators, might as well have come from fairyland as from Philip Wiley's plantation in Edenton.
"They're yours?"
I spoke to Wiley without looking at him, unwilling to take my eyes away from the enchanting sight.
"Wherever did you get them?"
"Yes," he said, his usual affectations erased by simple pride. "They are mine. They are Frisians, the oldest breed of warmbloods. Their lineage can be traced back for centuries."
"As to where I got them..."
He leaned over the fence, extending a hand, palm up, and wiggling his fingers toward the horses in invitation.
"I've been breeding them for several years. I brought these at Mrs. Cameron's invitation. She has it in mind, perhaps, to purchase one of my mares, and suggested that one or two of her neighbours might also be interested. As for Lucas here, though..."
The stallion had come over, recognising his owner, and was submitting gracefully to having his forehead rubbed.
"He is not for sale."
This ends Disc 20. The Fiery Cross, Disc 21.
Both mares were heavily in foal. Lucas was the sire, and so had been brought, Wiley said, as proof of the bloodlines.
"That," I thought, privately amused, "and for purposes of showing him off."
While his black pearls were exciting keen interest, and a number of the horse-breeding gentlemen from the neighbourhood had gone visibly green with envy at the sight of Lucas, Philip Wiley preened like a cock-grouse.
"Oh, there you are, Sassenach."
Jamie's voice came suddenly in my ear.
"I was looking for you."
"Were you indeed?"
I said, turning away from the paddock. I felt a sudden warmth under my breastbone at sight of him.
"And where have you been?"
"Oh, here and there,"
Jamie said, undisturbed by my tone of accusation.
"A very fine horse indeed, Mr. Wiley."
A polite nod, and he had me by the arm and headed back toward the lawn before Wiley's murmured,
"Your servant, sir,"
had been quite voiced.
"What are you doing out here with wee Philip Wiley?"
Jamie asked, picking his way through a flock of house slaves who streamed past from the cookhouse with platters of food steaming alluringly under white napkins.
"Looking at his horses," I said,
putting a hand over my stomach in hopes of suppressing the resounding borborygmy occasioned by the sight of food.
"And what have you been doing?"
"Looking for Duncan,"
he said, guiding me round a puddle.
"It wasn't in the necessary, nor yet the smithy, the stables, the kitchen, the cookhouse. I took a horse and rode out to the tobacco barns, but not a smell of the man."
"Perhaps Lieutenant Wolfe has assassinated him," I suggested, disappointed rival and all that.
"Wolfe?"
He stopped, frowning at me in consternation.
"Is yon gobshite here?"
"In the flesh," I replied, waving my fan toward the lawn.
Wolfe had taken up a station near the refreshment tables, his short, stout figure unmistakable in its blue and white naval uniform. "Do you suppose your aunt invited him?"
"Aye, I do,"
he said, sounding grim but resigned.
"She couldn't resist rubbing his nose in it, I expect."
"That's what I thought. He's only been here for half an hour or so, though. And if he goes on mopping it up at that rate," I added, looking disapprovingly at the bottle clutched in the lieutenant's hand, "he'll be out cold before the wedding takes place." Jamie dismissed the lieutenant with a contemptuous gesture.
"Well, then, let him pickle himself unwelcome, so long as he only opens his mouth to pour drinks in. Where's Duncan hidden himself, though?"
"Perhaps he's thrown himself in the river."
It was meant as a joke, but I glanced toward the river nonetheless, and saw a boat headed for the landing, the oarsman standing in the prow to throw his mooring rope to a waiting slave.
"Look, is that the priest at last?"
It was. A short, tubby figure, black soutane hiked up over hairy knees as he scrambled ignominiously onto the dock, with the help of a push from the boatman below. Ulysses was already hurrying down to the landing to greet him.
"Good,"
Jamie said, in tones of satisfaction.
"We've a priest, then, and a bride. 2 out of 3, that's progress. Here, Sassenach, wait a bit. Your hair's coming down."
He traced the line of a fallen curl slowly down my back, and I obligingly let the shawl fall back from my shoulders. Jamie put up the curl again with a skill born of long practice, then kissed me gently on the nape of the neck, making me shiver. He wasn't immune to the prevailing airs of spring either.
"I suppose I must go on looking for Duncan," he said, with a tinge of regret.
His fingers lingered on my back, thumb delicately tracing the groove of my spine.
"Once I've found him, though, there must be some place here with a bit of privacy to it."
The word privacy made me lean back against Jamie and glance toward the river bank where a clump of weeping willows sheltered a stone bench. Quite a private and romantic spot, especially at night. The willows were thick with green, but I caught a flash of scarlet through the drooping branches.
"Got him!"
I exclaimed, straightening up so abruptly that I trod on Jamie's toe.
"Oh, sorry."
"Nae matter,"
he assured me. He had followed the direction of my glance and now drew himself up purposefully.
"I'll go and fetch him out. Do you go up to the house, Sassenach, and keep an eye on my aunt and the priest. Dinna let them escape until this marriage is made."
Jamie made his way down the lawn toward the willows, absently acknowledging the greetings of friends and acquaintances as he went. In truth, his mind was less on Duncan's approaching nuptials than on thoughts of his own wife. He was generally aware that he'd been blessed in her beauty, even in her usual homespun, knee-deep in mud from her garden, or stained and fierce with the blood of her calling. The curve of her bones spoke to his own marrow, and those whisky eyes could make him drunk with a glance. Besides, the mad collishangi of her hair made him laugh. Smiling to himself even at the thought, it occurred to him that he was slightly drunk.